cracking something up with me. Hey, sweet baby, don't you think maybe we could find us a brand new recipe?
Kansas City's restaurants have come a long way in a short time. We used to call ourselves a cow town, and with good reason. Steakhouses were our specialty, and vacations were the only chance we had to try adventurous cuisine. Now suddenly we're making lists of top cities for foodies, and our chefs are getting nominated for James Beard Awards. I'm Gina Kaufman, and today on KCUR's Central Standard, we're looking at the local restaurant scene and its dramatic transformation. I'm sitting here with food critic Charles Ferruza, and we've got food historian Andrea Broomfield on the line. Hi, Charles.
Hello, Gina.
And hello, Andrea.
Hi.
Well, Charles, what was the food scene like in Kansas City when you first arrived here a little more than 30 years ago?
Well, I'm trying. You know, it wasn't quite as backwoods as you're insinuating. I mean, it was a pretty.
Never exaggerate, Charles.
I know you've never been known to do that. It was a solid restaurant town, in a lot of ways. It was not as adventurous as Kansas City dining is now. I should also, you know, preface this by saying that I moved to Kansas City in 1984, and in 1986, which would have been 30 years ago, I was working in part-time in several restaurants, as I did for many years afterwards. And there were a lot of interesting kind of old-fashioned restaurants. Definitely there were a lot more steakhouses then than there are now. But, you know, for example, I don't remember... And Andre could chime in here, but when I moved here 30 years ago, I think there was one Thai restaurant in the metro and maybe one Vietnamese restaurant. If you count Willie downtown on Grand as a Vietnamese restaurant, because it was really more of a, it had more eclectic cuisine actually than just that. And we have a lot more ethnic possibilities now. But, you know, listen, we had good restaurants in the 80s, a lot of weird ones. But, you know, we had good restaurants.
School me a little more, Charles. I'm ready. I want to hear it. No, okay. I mean, like, I want the truth. Because I was a kid during this time, so I could just have some totally skewed perspective on all of this.
Well... In the 1980s, we still had a lot of restaurants that by the end of the decade were gone. And I should say that some of these restaurants, which were so weird, I never got a chance to go to because even then I was too much of a snob.
Like, what was so weird about them?
Well, there was the legendary Gold Buffet, which was down... Oh, gosh. I think it was...
It was down in North Kansas City.
It was in North Kansas City, and it was this weird combination.
In a bowling alley?
Attached to one.
It was attached to a bowling alley. And it was this weird, gigantic buffet filled with totally, you know, commonplace sort of weird foods. Like, you know, they had like a million Jell-O salads and things like that. And but really, their calling card was not so much the food, although it was apparently plentiful. Their calling card was they would have these sort of has-been, B-rated Vegas sort of acts. It was a showroom, you know, where you would go and see a show. And they had like, do you remember Foster Brooks?
No.
Foster Brooks was sort of a standard... I don't know, grade C celebrity of the 70s, where he performed as a drunk. I'm here to tell you about, you know. And Foster Brooks was very much a fixture at the Gold Buffet, and people loved him.
Well, see, this is not actually doing anything to dissuade me from my previous idea that this was...
Well, I was grabbing for the weirdest.
Yeah. Yeah, Andrea, talk to me about the 1980s. Kind of a broad view of the food scene in Kansas City.
Well, I would agree with Charles, but there were some really interesting forays into ethnic food that were beginning to happen in the 80s that were more high end, like Al Rubay and Nabil's. These were restaurants that focused loosely on Middle Eastern cuisine.
I want to say very, very, very loosely.
Al Rubay attempted to showcase foods from all countries that face the Mediterranean, for example, offering dishes like hummus. Nabil's was distinctly Middle Eastern in a lot of its food, including things like tabbouleh. So you're starting to see in the 80s more attention paid to ethnic cuisine in a way that is sort of showcasing the quality of the food with the environment itself. But you also had some very odd places like the Golden Temple, which was down off of Maine, and Arbor V. These are sort of the classic hippie health food places.
Now, Andre, I was under the impression, because it was closed before I moved here, but I thought the Golden Temple was where the Corner restaurant is now.
Well, there were a couple locations. The first was on Maine, and then there was one in Westport as well. But I don't know when they went out of business. These are before my time.
Well, Andrea, I want to talk to you about some other trends during the 1980s. I've heard this described as the era of the hotel restaurant in Kansas City.
Right. Well, a lot of the fine dining was still taking place in hotels, and so one of the most popular would have been the Peppercorn Duck Club in the Hyatt Regency, and of course the Skies at the top of the Hyatt, which just recently closed. But even if you think about the American Restaurant, which was not in a hotel per se, but obviously at Crown Center and connected to the Westin Hotel, and then you had places like La Bona Berge, which I think for a short time at least was part of the Ramada downtown. And
Andrea,
so there was a long tradition of having hotels host the finest of restaurants in Kansas City.
Why? Why did that happen?
Well, first of all, I think that when people travel, the assumption is that they've got money, and they also want the convenience of having something to eat that's really close to where they're staying. But Kansas City was always a crossroads, and it always had a tradition of trying to serve the needs of travelers, and so hotels and restaurants went together. But I think you see that obviously in other cities, Chicago, New York, Boston. But Kansas City had an established reputation as a place where lots of planes were coming through in the days before KCI opened. And the downtown municipal airport was very close to where most people were going to stay, which was downtown. And they associated downtown with a great place to sleep and a great place to eat.
Charles, jump in here.
Yeah, I want to say that almost every large city of this type had a long history of the best restaurants in town being in a hotel. And Kansas
Absolutely.
City has had a lot of good hotels, not always just downtown. I mean, Armour Boulevard, for example, had a lot of hotels, and with good restaurants, memorable restaurants.
In what time period are we talking about?
This would have been probably the 20s and 30s.
Right, so we're going back further than the 80s.
Oh, yeah, further than the 80s. But when I moved here in the 80s, it's true that, like, for example, Crown Center, which had the Peppercorn Duck Club, which at that point, 30 years ago, was maybe one of the hottest restaurants in Kansas City. It was very hard to get into. And they were still doing things that amenities that restaurants wouldn't even consider doing anymore. For example, if you and your husband were going to be dining at the Peppercorn Duck Club, you can count on two things. One is that the woman in the party would get a red rose, fresh red rose.
Right.
And the man would, not to be left empty-handed, would have matchbooks embossed with his name.
Whoa.
Yeah.
Oh, my goodness.
That sounds awesome.
They were still doing that really pretty toward the end. I should also remind Andrea that actually Skies closed about 3 or 4 years ago. It's been closed.
Right. It finally died out, but it was there up until just recently. And I just want to chime in with what Charles is saying. I remember that when I was a kid, you know, my parents would go out to dinner on Friday, and if they went to the Kona Kai, which I think was attached to the Hilton off of Maine, my mother would always come back home with a gardenia.
That's right.
So that was another one of these, you know, sort of special things that these hotel restaurants were doing for their patrons.
I want to jump in and talk about another trend. We'll get back to this hotel restaurant, but Gilbert Robinson.
Right.
Mm. Let's talk about the role that Kansas City-based chain had in in casual dining, because we talked about the hotel restaurant, which is really upscale dining.
The Gilbert Robinson chain, started by Bill Gilbert and Paul Robinson, it had started as early as the downtown airport in the late 40s, early 50s. But I would say that in the 1980s, that chain was really at its apex.
What restaurants Absolutely. Are we talking about?
Well, probably the best known from the 1980s would be Houlihan's, because it was a huge success, beyond their wildest dream success. And then, of course, their success led to them opening more and more restaurants on the Country Club Plaza. And so by the time I moved here in 84, Gilbert Robinson pretty much had the exclusives of restaurants on the Country Club Plaza. There was Annie Santa Fe, a restaurant that I thought was horrible, and but Beloved.
The Bristol.
The original Bristol. Let's see. Houlihan's.
Plaza 3.
Well, so lots of restaurants and ones that people would recognize. Andrea, talk to me about how a Kansas City-based chain shifted casual dining and what that meant in Kansas City.
Well, I think that they were so important because they were ahead of a lot of curves, including the importance of shopping centers and the fact that people had cars in order to travel away from streetcar lines and things like that. I think that their first really popular restaurant was actually in the Landing Shopping Center.
The Leather Bottle.
It was called the Inn on the Landing, and then it became the Leather Bottle. Wow. I think it's that chronology. But Gilbert Robinson realized that people wanted to be able to have food in a fun environment, and they did not want to have to always get so dressed up, and you know, have to go to a hotel dining room and be serenaded by violinists. They might just simply want to hire a babysitter and get in their car and go have a decent meal. Not extravagantly priced, but not cheap either, and not have to feel like it was a special occasion, like an anniversary or something like that.
But so, Andre, you're leaving out actually one of the most important components of the success of Gilbert Robinson, which was they came at roughly the same time as the sexual revolution.
Well,
and,
yes,
and those
I,
and those
I'm
restaurants.
Not leaving that out yet.
Well, I was going to say, and they were very singles friendly restaurants.
Absolutely, and they always had a singles bar. That was a pickup scene.
Yeah, it was very much a pickup scene in the 70s, and you know, you could count on if you were there for more than, I don't know, just to get an appetizer and a drink, you can count on that you will not run into your parents or anyone else of that generation.
This is just kind of a random question, but did they have dress codes in any of these restaurants?
A lot of them had what they would label as casual. So as high end as it got in a Gilbert Robinson would probably be like the Plaza 3, where you might be required to wear a coat jacket, but not a tie. But I think that what Charles is saying is so important, that, you know, these were places where people were hooking up, and they were usually coming into these places after work. And so, you know, there was just the dress code that you would have if you were getting off work. Probably you weren't in T-shirts and jeans, but you might very well be in a pantsuit and in a leisure suit.
Without a tie.
Right, without a tie.
Although jeans were coming into vogue about that time,
right? Because,
you know, that you could, yeah, that you weren't shamed to wear jeans.
Well, right, Charles. I mean, we're talking about a lot of restaurants that were located on the plaza, and I remember, I mean, as recently as the early 2000s, when you and I worked together at the Pitch, you used to say that the plaza was our real downtown, especially when it came to dining. I mean, that did seem to be true at one time, but has the geography of our dining habits changed?
Oh, I think it's evolved. I mean, this is why I believed at the time that Kansas City's dining community had very, very much moved south to the plaza for a couple reasons. One is that, there were very, very few restaurants in the 1980s still downtown. I can maybe think of a handful, one being the...
And they were suffering.
They were suffering badly, and they were, you know, they were tourist trappy kind of places, and But in the, at least until, I want to say 1986, when the liquor laws finally changed in Kansas, it was very unusual for someone or a group of people to decide, we're going to go out to dinner.
Can we talk about how those liquor laws changed? Because I think a lot of people remember this, but not all of our listeners.
Well, it was when I moved here in 84, I couldn't get over the draconian liquor laws in Kansas. If you wanted a cocktail, for example, buy a glass, you know, buy the drink, you had to have a club card. And, you know, it wasn't that difficult to get a club card, but it was like, you know, one more extra step. And it was, you know, sort of like, you know, having a babysitter. And I believe that all changed in 1986, but it was like one more step of Big Brother kind of looking at what you did.
Well, and it cost money. I mean, you had to pay for this. I think it was a yearly fee.
And that's not true in the 80s. When I came in the 1980s, really, there was no fees involved. I don't remember a fee involved, and I was still drinking.
Okay. But when I started at the University of Kansas, I could have sworn that people who had a club card had to pay a yearly fee, but I couldn't drink, so.
Well, would have been yet another draconian step, I think. But I just remember that you had to fill out some paperwork to get a club card. I don't remember.
So just to have a drink with dinner, you had to have a special card.
A club card,
in the whole state of Kansas. So like
that because
you didn't have very many restaurants that offered alcohol as a result of that. So Charles is saying that, you know, if you really wanted to have a drink with dinner and feel like a grown-up, you probably were going to cross over into Missouri.
Right.
And downtown is kind of semi-abandoned at this point, at least, I mean, in many respects, but we're specifically with respect to restaurants. So the Plaza starts becoming the destination. But what about, like, there are neighborhoods that have their own restaurant histories, like Westport, like that strip of 39th
yeah.
Street.
Waldo.
Yeah.
Well, let me comment on 39th Street. Because we have become so used to knowing the stretch of 39th Street, which extends pretty much from Southwest Traffic Way to State Line, we've most of us, I'm old enough to remember when it wasn't this way, forget that until Cafe Allegro, which was a very upscale and fancy restaurant that Steve Cole started in 1984, 39th Street was a stretch of mostly kind of creepy bars.
Right.
And a couple things came along to change it. One was Frickin' Fracks, which was kind of a fun, groovy, hip bar even then. And I remember a biker bar being there. I remember that, you know, it wasn't for several years after 1984, that it really became a serious destination point for dining.
Andrea, do you want to say anything about the neighborhoods of Kansas City restaurants, like where they tend to be, where the real destinations in town are?
Well, in the 1980s, I think Warnell is still a really important restaurant corridor. You've got places like Cafe Nile, you've got old-time places like the Berliner Bear, and then you've got Jasper's, which was at 75th Street and was considered one of the best northern Italian restaurants back before it moved over to 103rd. So the Waldo-Warnell corridor, I think, was really important. It was also the home of places like Prince's Garden, which in the early 80s would have been one of the first places in Kansas City for Chinese food that was not Cantonese, but rather Szechuan. So it had a pretty hopping scene going.
So we have,
and then you also do have the development of the Watts Mill area, where Jasper then moved by, I think, when was that, 90s?
Early 90s, yes.
Mm-hmm. And Warnell began to decline, I think, as a restaurant destination.
Why? I mean, there was a distinct personality for the restaurants there. I would call them
right
dark. Naturally dark. We now have natural light. That was natural dark. And I don't know, carpeted a lot of them?
Probably. Well, you know, I bet Charles can speak better to that move than I can, but I'm just going to guess that the Kansas liquor laws changing would have had a profound influence on the direction of where restaurants began to locate.
Right, because it, you're right, Andre,
County
because
it, were growing.
It opened brand new restaurants.
Yeah.
And by this point, you know, there was already an exodus from Midtown Kansas City to the suburbs as
right.
the baby boomers started having children. So the liquor laws enabled new neighborhoods, I'm thinking Prairie Village, Corinth,
Prairie
and
Village.
Things like that, to open their own places. And I also might note that another big influence on neighborhood restaurants at this point is also the very, very quick and very powerful success of Mothers Against Drunk Driving. People did not like to drive great distances, and there was really no public transportation if they've had
right.
a few drinks, because Mothers Against Drunk Driving was a very potent force, as well it should have been.
Right.
And so new restaurant communities developed in neighborhoods where mom and dad, if they wanted to go out for a couple cocktails when they put the kids down, they could have, you know, a burger and a beer or a cocktail and not have to drive more than maybe 3 or 4 blocks, if even that.
So the neighborhood
right.
dynamic has changed a lot. But Charles, when we talk about food trends, when you step back and say, okay, 30 years ago until now, Kansas City's dining scene, what would you say has changed in terms of our relationship with food trends, and what stayed the same?
Andre, I'm going to ask you to jump in here while I contemplate
sure.
what I want to say here.
Well, in terms of trends that I think started in the 80s that have become stronger, it would be the rise of chains. I think back in the 80s, there were, we think of fast food as a chain, but I'm thinking of places that started coming into town like Rusty Scupper or Baby Doe's Matchless Mine or Chi-Chi's, Trader Vic's, those kind of places begin to make a pretty strong mark on Kansas City dining in the 1980s. And today the Plaza, I think, is primarily chain restaurants. So that's a trend that came and has not declined. There's been a definite decline in the informal dining where men are expected to be in suits and ties. I can't think of any restaurant in Kansas City at this point that requires even a coat jacket.
Charles, anything you want to add?
Well, I want to point out also that, as I think Andre would agree, that the chain restaurants, and let's face it, chain restaurants have a great history in Kansas City because of two restaurateurs, Fred Harvey, which goes
right.
all the way back to the railroad days. You know, he developed something that Americans really, really fell in love with, which was consistency. It didn't matter where in the country you went to a Fred Harvey restaurant, the food and the service were going to be exactly the same.
Right. I want to jump into this 1980 till now time period, though, and think about not just naming the trends, but like, what is Kansas City's relationship to trend? Right now, it feels like we are maybe closer to the cutting edge than we used to be, but I'm not sure if I am accurate in perceiving that, Charles.
I would say you're not accurate. I would say that Kansas City is historically maybe 1 or 2 years behind any kind of a novelty trend.
Yes.
And trends, novelty trends especially, don't tend to last very long here. They're known for, you know, really coming and going relatively quickly. One restaurant chain that kind of comes to my mind immediately, and I actually worked for it in Indianapolis, was the Magic Pan, which was the crepe chain owned by Pillsbury. And it was very, very hot. But, you know, when the novelty goes, it goes.
When KCOR's Central Standard returns, we'll talk to one of Kansas City's chef owners who's been involved in the food renaissance. We'll hear the personal story of Room 39's Ted Habiger. And we'll want to hear your observations about what's changed, what hasn't, and what you'd still like to see more of in Kansas City restaurants. I'm Gina Kaufman. Stay tuned.
Some other man got my woman. Lonesome Blues got me. But she better come on.
I'm Gina Kaufman. This is KCUR's Central Standard, and I've been talking to Charles Ferruza and Andrea Broomfield about changes in Kansas City's restaurant scene since the 1980s. what some might say were a dark ages for local food. Others might find that a little extreme. But what comes after a dark age is usually a renaissance. We're trying to understand what's behind the restaurant renaissance we've been experiencing here. Call 816-235-2888 to tell us what's changed, what hasn't, and what you'd still like to see more of in Kansas City restaurants. 816-235-2888. Now I want to talk to Ted Habiger. He's the chef and owner of Room 39, one of the first farm-to-table restaurants in town. And Ted, that's a huge trend now. But did it feel sort of risky when you opened Room 39?
Not at all. Not to me. I mean, I'd been kind of doing it at Cafe Allegro before that. And once I went to New York, it just became a I worked at Union Square Cafe out there, and we were a block away from the farmer's market. And so it was kind of natural to just go to the market and go get your vegetables. And then when we moved back home, I wasn't going to do anything else. I mean, that was what I was going to do for sure. And to be honest, I feel like I think like our customers got us before maybe even the press did, with the exception of you, Charles, of course. But the but there was a period of time where I felt like we were kind of one of the only ones doing it. And then there was and then Jonathan Justice came into town and got some really good national press and started doing farm to table stuff up in Smithville. And that's when I saw other restaurateurs start to follow that lead that we had kind of started at that point.
Take me back with you through the journey that you've kind of alluded to, where you had left town and come back. First of all, you're from Kansas City.
Right.
Did you have some youthful restaurant jobs here in town that maybe inspired you or left some other kind of impression?
Well, my first job ever was at the Village Green restaurant in Prairie Village, where Minsky's is now. And that was a, you know, it's interesting because you think back, because we made everything from scratch. You know, a lot of restaurants don't do that anymore. Especially
when you say everything, like what kinds of things did you make from scratch that would now maybe be not that way?
For instance, crab rangoon was on the menu. So we were actually filling crab rangoon. We were making the filling. We were forming them into their shells and then frying them from there. Very simple process. And it was using, you know, this was fake crab and some other things, some ingredients that I wouldn't use today. But at least we weren't buying them out of a box already formed and frozen and then just shoving them into a freezer and then making them from there. You know, we grated our own cheese and it was very simple food, but it was at least it was like had some, you know, human touch to it.
There was something else sort of oddly forward thinking about that restaurant, which is that is the first time I remember using a telephone to call someone else basically in the same room.
Correct.
Which now we do all the time now that we have cell phones. But you ordered by telephone at the table.
Right. My sister actually was the receptionist, at, you know, behind the counter. And the bar was not, you know, this is before liquor by the drink. And the bar was actually in the room with the dishwasher. So she would take the orders and then go back and make drinks for people. And then, you know, and then there would be a food runner. So there was no servers. There were just kind of food runners.
And you mentioned that you left town and that your restaurant career, you know, you had a restaurant career in New York before you came back to Kansas City. What brought you back here?
Well, my wife and I got engaged out there, and my girlfriend at the time, she's from Kansas City also, and is instrumental in everything we do in the restaurants these days. But we decided that we wanted to raise our family in Kansas City. And I also felt like if we were going to own a place, which is really the dream, was to own our own place, we had to do it in a place where we had support. You know, we needed our families nearby. We needed maybe a smaller market. You know, I didn't want to I couldn't open up something in Manhattan, you know, in the island of Manhattan, or I couldn't do it in Brooklyn at the time. I didn't have that kind of cash. So we decided let's try it in Kansas City.
Do you think that your story is like other chef stories in Kansas City? I mean, what's your perception of how the food talent in Kansas City has kind of incubated?
Yeah, you know, it's very similar. I think the story that Megan and Colby Geraltz is very similar to the story that Jackie and I went through where we were.
And they're at Blue Stem and Rye.
Right, exactly. Where we both left town right around the same time. He was working at the Stolen Grill, which was a great restaurant. And he went to Chicago and then went on to L.A. and learned from some fantastic chefs and came back with confidence and a little bit of cachet, you know, and some, you know, and got their place open. Same sort of thing we did. And I feel like since then, there have been more of that has occurred where people have gone away or maybe learned from one of these restaurants, it's kind of built upon itself.
Are there certain, like, characters whose storylines intersect? Because I get the feeling that Kansas City's food scene, like you're saying, is made up of a lot of people who moved away from here, came back at around the same time,
yeah,
are all friends now, support each other's businesses in a sort of, like, informal club.
It is a little bit.
How did that happen? What is the connection between all of you guys?
You know, I think it's about passion, you know, and about the love of food. And the way I started in the business, and like really, so I was working at 75th Street Brewery as a chef, and we were making very good food from scratch. And I met a guy sitting at the bar that day wearing those like Zumba chef pants, you know, and I was like, oh, great. Where do you work? And he's like, I work at the best restaurant in Kansas City. And I said, well, what's that? And he goes, Cafe Allegro. And I had never heard of it. And this was 1994. And I'm 24 years old. I should know about this place. And so I immediately went down and got a job there. And that guy ended up being my best man in my wedding, you know, that I met that day. The other chefs that were there have all gone on to do other great things. I ended up going to New York. While I was out there, an intern comes in from the CIA, which is the Culinary Institute of America.
Different CIA
right
than most of us are used to hearing about in the news.
So, but we always had one intern every 6 months or so. And this intern was a gentleman named Howard Hanna. And one day I'm sitting there working and he's shucking oysters or something. And I turn around and I'm listening to him and I'm like, boy, your accent, where are you from? He says, I'm from Manhattan. And I'm like, Manhattan, Kansas? And at that point, I was like, I always laid the groundwork. I was like, okay, if you ever come back to Kansas City, we're getting ready to move there. I want to work with you in Kansas City. And sure enough, he comes back to Kansas City. I wasn't ready yet. And I was working at 40 Sardines, which is a Michael and Debbie place. And Howard Hanna starts working for us and there. And then as soon as we got Room 39 open, he started working with us there. And we've had several people that have kind of come through there. And there's been this incestual sort of restaurant employee, you know, situation where we've got all these different people that now own restaurants that either worked for Michael and Debbie, Colby and Megan, Room 39, worked for Steve Cole before. You know, it's just kind of has happened.
So I'm curious about the role of a particular institution, and I'm going to turn to Charles on this for a second. Charles Ferruzza, our food critic who's joining us for this show. What about the role of the American restaurant in this? I mean, we've talked about the hotel restaurants and a certain era of fine dining, but did the American restaurant have a particular role in incubating talent?
Well, I would say it is the number one restaurant that did that. For one thing, they had unlike probably most restaurants in Kansas City and the history of the Midwest even, they had unlimited resources. They could afford to hire the very, very best chefs around the country.
So,
and not only afford to hire them, but afford to publicize them in national magazines.
Do you think that, I mean, if you think about other kinds of industries, it's you can't, though, lure people to a total vacuum and expect them to be interested in that or to stay. I mean, so what's the relationship between these things? I mean, was there enough of a thriving scene around it that people?
Well, I don't think that really mattered. I mean, you know, to work for the Hall family and Hallmark in this gorgeous restaurant, maybe one of the most beautiful restaurants ever, and to have a pretty free creative license. By the 1980s, the American was a great incubator for young up-and-coming chefs, maybe the best ever. And they all went on to bigger and better things.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's not like they had to make money.
So, Ted, you alluded to this earlier, but do you think that there's, you know, you've talked about that customers embrace the farm-to-table concept faster than the press. And I'm curious also, not just about the change in customers, but there's a third piece of that, which is the farm. I mean, did farmers have an adjustment to make as this trend started evolving, getting used to working directly with a restaurant in the city?
Absolutely. I mean, I get the question a lot where people ask me, how do you meet the farmers? How do you end up buying the produce from them? And at first, it started out with us as chefs going to the city market every Saturday morning or every Wednesday and picking up all these vegetables and developing the relationships like that. That's how we met Thane Palmberg and some others. But now the farmers actually come to us. You know, they walk in the back door of the restaurant. They're like, hey, I've got a new farm that we're making, you know, or we just found a bunch of chanterelle mushrooms or something. And these sorts of things are actually coming to us now. I mean, I think I have 17 different farmers that I work with on a permanent to semi-permanent basis, and it's a lot.
Andrea Broomfield, food historian, what can you tell us? I mean, this is a trend that we've all observed, but is there something underneath it, a kind of cultural evolution that has accompanied just the mere fact that this is different?
Well, I would just chime in with what we've been talking about to say that in some ways what's happening now with farmers coming up to the door and talking directly to the chef probably was pretty much the casual way that these relationships evolved back in the 1890s, 1900s, particularly as Italians began to move into the city market area and they began to develop relationships with other chefs and other food vendors and beginning to forge those relationships in the greengrocer and the fishmonger businesses. So
it's not just the long beards that take us back to the 19th century?
it just seems that things go around and come around again. And for many, many years, there were direct relationships between farmers and restaurateurs, and for that matter, between grocers and farmers, because many grocers had their own fields where they were bringing in their produce.
I'm Gina Kaufman. When KCOR's Central Standard returns, we'll bring an investment and entrepreneurship expert in on this discussion. Where do dollars and cents fit into this story? Andrea Broomfield, Kansas City food historian with us from Johnson County Community College. I know you have a class to teach, so I'm going to let you go.
Thanks
so much.
Okay, but it was a lot of fun. Bye-bye.
Bye. We'll be right back. Welcome back to KCUR's Central Standard. I'm Gina Kaufman, and we've been talking about food, trying to understand the dramatic change in Kansas City's food scene over the last decade plus. And what is it they say? Follow the money? Let's do that now. Kate Hodel is with us from KC SourceLink. She looks for capital for entrepreneurs, and she used to be with the Kaufman Foundation, so she's been in this game for a while. Hi, Kate.
Hi, how are you?
Good. What can you tell us about how restaurants are financed here in Kansas City?
Well, that's probably something that hasn't changed in 30 years. It's hard to get money to finance a restaurant. Always has been, probably always will be. There's sort of a continuum, and the first place you start is with your own personal savings and friends, family. Lots of times people think there are grants out there for their businesses and loan programs. Those come into play a little bit later on down the road. We were just talking about Ted's financing journey, and typically you go from personal savings, friends and family, then to perhaps a microloan, then perhaps an SBA-backed loan, and then we can really show financials.
SBA, Small Business Association?
Small Business Administration, yes. They back loans for all kinds of businesses, including restaurants.
So are there changes in Kansas City's restaurant scene that you would trace to the money piece of it?
Well, I think that what we've seen is that people are getting very creative about how to get into the restaurant industry at less cost, which means lower startup dollars needed. And so you see the emergence of commercial kitchens that are available for rent. So if you want to start a catering business first and build up your clientele that way, the Innovation Center in Independence, the farm-to-table incubator in the River Market, and then the Olathe Commercial Kitchen. We've also seen people starting food trucks. That's another way of building up a reputation and then moving on to a restaurant. Jazzy B's just did that in the last few months.
So, you know, restaurants do have a really high failure rate, don't they?
Well, it's interesting. Most small businesses don't have the best of statistics. I don't know that I was looking around to see. I don't think that restaurants have any higher failure rate than any other small business. I think what happens frequently is that restaurant owners decide it's just a lot of work and a very toll on your family life.
So you have burnout.
Absolutely. And it just may be that when restaurants fail, people notice that more than if a tailor goes out of business or a shoe repairman or a dentist.
Ted, what are your thoughts about how money might be related to the change we've seen in Kansas City restaurants over the last 10, 15 years?
Yeah, I kind of have a theory on that, that, you know, where entrepreneurship, we were just talking about this in the break room earlier, that it kind of starts when there's a downturn in the economy. Like, there's more entrepreneurship when there is something like that happen. And in 2008 and 2009, when we had the Great Recession, what that did in the restaurant business, and I think it really fueled the amount of chef owners that are out there, it made a lot of places closed. And it made places with infrastructure available for chef owners to get in there, and landlords needed somebody in there. And so very good deals were made with people where, okay, the restaurant or the space has a hood system. That's a huge expense. That's $30,000 or $40,000 that people just don't have money for. But if it's already there, then you can go in and basically all you got to do is buy your equipment and your food and get going, you know, paint the walls, that sort of thing.
I mean, that is such a real estate thing. I mean, it was a buyer's market for home buyers, but it sounds like it was a buyer's market for aspiring.
Completely. And I would argue that that's how we got the Rieger. You know, thank God for the recession. Do we get great restaurants like that? You know, it made it easier for chef owners to go in and start a business with very little money.
That's so interesting.
And it was, as opposed to like the big, huge corporation that hires a chef where the food isn't really coming from the chef down. It's coming, you know, the rules are coming from somebody who has nothing to do with food. And so you don't get as good of a restaurant that way, or certainly not as top tier or interesting or cutting edge, because no one's taking risks.
And but because you're trying to satisfy a non-food person's idea, right, of what should be happening.
Right. You're trying to satisfy profits or something, and so you lose that passion. But that the chef-owner thing really exploded in Kansas City, I think, because of the recession.
Kate Hodel, do you think, as someone who works with small business owners, passion, that can be a double-edged sword? I mean, someone who's thinking more about passion than the dollars and cents is... Have you seen that had a detrimental effect in any way?
Oh, of course you have to have passion to get any kind of business off the ground. What we've been seeing in the Kansas City market is an emergence of resources to help people add to their passion and their expertise in the culinary world with that business sense. Not everybody who's a chef understands how to run the dollars and cents. And there are a number of resources, score counselors, small business development centers, mentors who can help these business owners. And Casey SourceLink, of course, is a resource for that. You can go there and get connected to those kinds of resources if you're thinking about starting a business. There are also classes out there. The Mid-Continent Public Library is having special classes for people who want to start food trucks, of all things. So I think it's that balance between the passion and then being able to really knuckle down and understand how do I run this as a business.
So also just a change in our attitude toward entrepreneurship.
Oh, I think definitely we've seen an emergence of entrepreneurship in the Kansas City market. I think once we started saying, let's make this America's most entrepreneurial city, people started to get excited about it. I think the resources were there, but I think they're more visible now. But it's still not easy to start a small business, and probably shouldn't be. The other thing I would point out is that the health departments have gotten a lot better about being able to help restaurateurs understand what they need to do in order to be up to code.
So, Charles, you've watched trends come and go, and you've seen restaurants.
That's what happens when you age.
And when you work for a while, you know, you have been a restaurant critic in the city for a while. And so that lets you see more than just one trend come and go. And you've seen restaurants cluster in one neighborhood after another. After watching patterns, do you have any predictions for what's next in Kansas City's restaurant scene? I mean, do you see all, know all?
No. And I think a lot of people would agree with me that I don't. But I will say this. I got my own little unofficial master's degree in restaurants by actually working in them for so long. And, you know, I remember back in an earlier time and place when I first met Kate and I was working in restaurants, I would think, how do these places even get along when they're clearly not going to be around for like two more minutes? But I would say that it's harder to get those loans now. Thus, I want to say that restaurants are going to have to start out on a lot more firmer footing than they do now or have been in the past. I also think that in terms of upcoming trends, I think we're going to start seeing, although they're hugely popular, I think we're going to start seeing less chain restaurants open. I really do. I think people are getting tired of them. Plus, I think they've lost over the last 15 or 20 years a lot of cachet.
Yeah, there used to be cachet in just going to the place that was recognizable. And now that's right. Shifted toward the place that's unique.
Right, right. And you know, and people tended, you know, at least at an earlier time, not to want to take children to anything except a chain restaurant because they were family friendly, for whatever that means. And now I'm seeing a shift in that too, that, you know, you could take your children just about anywhere except for maybe, you know, the Shady Lady.
Well, Ted Haviger, chef owner at Room 39, you're within the industry, so the changes that we're all maybe not going to notice on our menus for 5, 10, 20 years, if, you know, are there things already percolating that you think we're all going to start noticing?
Yeah, I mean, I think you're going to see more and it's almost an extension of what's happening now with farm-to-table restaurants. Like, I think about, like, a specific ingredient that you almost have to have. If you're a farm-to-table restaurant, you almost have to have something with sorghum. You know, it's like, it's just kind of the way it is now. You know,
you see the day when people will come in with their very own sorghum?
I know, exactly.
From their backyard and
put
ask
it in
you
their
to
coffee.
Cook it.
Yeah, exactly.
You what know, what is behind that, though? Is there something in agriculture that's driving those new, exciting ingredients that sort of seem to emerge one by one?
Well, they're really old ingredients. I think about pawpaws. Like, you know, did pawpaws exist 20 years ago? Of course they did. But we weren't seeing them on restaurants and, you know, restaurant menus. And
because we considered them to be weeds.
Right, exactly. You know, and, you know, nettles, like one of our farmers just discovered a second variety of nettle that grows during the hot months of the summer. And we've been using them for about a year and a half now. So I think it's going to be continued. You can almost take old cookbooks from like the 20s or 30s or turn of the century and look stuff up there. And that's what you're going to see, you know, in the next 10 years, 15 years.
Pawpaw stew.
Yeah.
Well, and I'm curious about, you know, we've talked about how the restaurants and the restaurant scene has changed for the positive. Are there areas where we could still stand to do some significant growing? We had a call from someone named Greg who feels like service in local restaurants is still in need of improvement.
Oh, I would agree. You know, I think that there's still a little bit of a perception amongst, certainly people older than my age. I'm 46.
And there's, that would be me.
Right? Well, there's a certain people that, you know, that don't feel like it's a noble profession to be a server. And I think you can make a really great living and have a great life and be a server for a long time. And
Ted, you could thank the American Diner for that, actually. Right? Because, no, they're very dismissive of servers.
I agree. And they're hardworking people, you know, and deserve a good wage. And you know, the good ones get a good wage, that's for sure. But I do believe that that service could be better.
But you're pointing out maybe a disconnect between the community of people who work in restaurants and the community of people who eat at restaurants, and especially now that people eat at restaurants really frequently,
right.
A disconnect as far as, is this my kitchen where I'm in charge, or am I going to sort of watch a master at the craft? You know what I mean?
Right. I mean, we always look for people that have the confidence to be able to take someone who's having a bad day and just lead them through a therapy session, basically, you know, having that confidence to be like, I know you guys are in a fight right now, but let me tell you about our food and let me tell you what you're going to have and let's have fun, you know.
Before we go, Kate Hodel, I mean, I am curious. People always need food that is eternal. I suspect it always will be, though I guess you never know. But with all of our enthusiasm about food and restaurants right now, is there a chance that we could be in a restaurant bubble?
I don't think so. I think you're right. I think that there are always going to be people who want experiences and want to get out of the kitchen. I think that the challenge will be for those restaurant owners to think about, how do I take this excitement, this passion, this vision I have, and then how do I tie that with some real world business acumen so that I can have that kind of successful experience that not only works for me, but works for those people who are going to work for me and come into my restaurant to enjoy it.
Our time is up. Kate Hodel of KC Source Link, thanks for your insights into restaurant investment.
You're welcome.
and Ted Habiger of Room 39 and the upcoming Brewery Imperial. Thank you.
Thank you.
Charles Ferruza, we'll be seeing you on Friday during our next food show about tacos.
See.
This conversation about the past, present, and future of our emerging food scene will be available online at kcur.org/centralstandard, and you can be sure you never miss one of these shows by subscribing to our podcast. Tomorrow, we will step back from this crazy election to hear stories from people who ran for office in student government, where it turns out there's plenty of disruption, controversy, and character building. KCUR Central Standard is produced by Matthew Long Middleton, Sylvia Maria Gross, Jen Chen, and Andrea Tudhope, with help from interns Raven Brooks and Aaron Pelish. I'm Gina Kaufman.